Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The biggest lesson in any of this and in life is, like, if you know where you want to go, like, you have to tell everybody. Everybody knows where you're going. Generally, they will, like, help you get there.
Hey everyone, I'm Amy Devers and this is Clever. Today I'm talking to Kathy Bailey, creative director of Heath Ceramics. Kathy grew up in New Jersey, deeply influenced by the technological innovation and optimism emanating from Bell Labs, where her father worked. She studied industrial design at Syracuse University and founded San Francisco-based product design consultancy One & Co. Then around 2003, she and her husband Robin were looking for their next creative endeavor when they stumbled upon a struggling small-scale pottery in Sausalito, California. Heath Ceramics was originally founded in 1948 by ceramicist Edith Heath and her husband Brian. The pieces are and have always been handcrafted in Northern California and beloved for their durable and timeless modern simplicity. The brand flourished during the mid-century, but then fell on hard times as the founding couple aged and consumerism shifted towards the fast, cheap, and mass-produced. That's when Kathy and Robin entered the equation, and since that day in 2003 have lovingly stewarded Heath Ceramics into modern times without sacrificing the integrity and heritage that make the pieces and the brand so deeply lovable. Let's get the story from Kathy.
I'm Catherine Bailey, and I live in Sausalito, California, and I work in Sausalito and also in San Francisco. I'm a designer, and I think I'm a guider of creative ideas, and I do this because I enjoy creating beautiful things that I feel like are worth having. I'm also good at understanding what needs to be done to turn that into business, so I'm the owner, along with my husband, and creative director of Heath Ceramics.
What an amazing story that is, and we're going to get the whole story from you. But before we get to Heath, I always like to understand, like, how you got to be Kathy. Let's go all the way back to the beginning. Where did you grow up, and what was your childhood like? Tell me about your family and the kinds of things that fascinated you.
So I grew up in Homedale, New Jersey, which is it's a suburban town about 45 minutes outside of New York City. And I always felt like growing up in New Jersey, like around that area, everything was defined by its distance from Manhattan or its exit on the parkway or something. It, like, there wasn't like a lot of there other than that. And we were there because my parents came from Indiana, and my dad got a job and moved out to New Jersey to work at Bell Labs. And Bell Labs in that time was like this really kind of important technology research center. Like, now I think of it as kind of a mythical place because it was such a, it was just iconic kind of place at that point in time. And what was interesting for me is the place, the physical place, was like, is like a really big memory for me. It was this, the place where my dad worked was a Arrow Saarinen building, and it was gigantic. It was like 2 million square feet. And it was like, it was kind of like the Apple Park of today, I think. And it has a huge memory in my mind of being this like immense, important place that felt really important. And my dad worked there, which was really cool. Yeah, it was kind of fascinating to me. And as someone who's grown up to really interested in spaces and how they make you feel, like that's kind of, I think, where it all started, is this kind of incredible building. But I used to go there a lot when I was little, and the entire basement was filled with a computer that processed like on punch cards. So my dad would bring those home for me to make things with and play with, and it would just like, it was a very different time.
But it does sound like sort of the laboratory, the epicenter of evolution, of like what was going to happen to the built world was being thought of and figured out right there in that Saarinen building.
It literally was like a lot of the basis for where we are today in technology was started there, like all the wireless technology, like the programming systems. The transistor was invented in that building, and there were like many Nobel Prizes that came out of the work going on there. So, you know, I didn't know that at the time, but it did feel important because of the structure and kind of what it felt like there. So when I look back and you see where it's all gone, it's really kind of fascinating still. In the basement, there was like this little like area where they had products that like how the technology was working into products. And it was just, you know, mind-blowing. It was like looking at the future, and there was something called a picture phone, which when you think that, you know, I grew up thinking that that was like this fantasy future, and they had one, and at the moment it was like, it's just the context and perspective that gives you now, I think, is super fascinating. But yeah, so
I'm thinking as a child too, like not knowing exactly where it would all lead, but knowing that there's this incredible generative energy coming out of that place where your dad works, and you kind of you're picking up on that energy and you have a window into it. It must have given you just this incredibly expansive view of the future.
Yeah, it was super optimistic. I think I look back and I grew up in this very idealistic, and the future was filled with opportunity, and it was all very positive. And it was very around me, everything was very science-based. I mean, I remember there was a kid in my class, and his dad won the Nobel Prize while we were in school together. And like, he lived down the street, right? And you knew, even when you're a kid, you're like, oh yeah, no, that's big, right?
Yeah.
So I grew up like with all this science around me, and that was my dad's world. It was a math science kind of world, but that really wasn't me. Like I from the very beginning was like not inept at it, but it didn't feel like my thing. And my mom was a speech therapist and a teacher, but she stayed at home with us until my younger sister went to school, and I was already in high school at that point. So yeah, it was just this really like optimistic kind of childhood in this suburban place with science and the future like at the center of it. Those are my memories of that time, of it feeling really optimistic, and everything felt very positive. I think even going through, I went to public school there, and it was like, it was a very good, safe place where the future was bright. And, you know, we had gotten through most of the problems. Most of the problems in the world were like in the past, and we were setting out in this like new age of optimism. Then I got to college and I was like, oh, actually.
Well, yes, college tends to open your eyes in that way to all the discord that needs fixing. But you said that science kind of wasn't your thing, but your dad was bringing home these punch cards for you to make things out of. How were you finding and expressing your creativity in your adolescence?
Yeah, I think I always liked to make stuff, you know, just kind of as kids do, but I was really persistent in it. So yeah, I was like, bring me more punch cards. I have more ideas. There's more things to build. And then as I got a little older, I think, you know, I was into all kinds of different stuff, but nothing like really deeply. When I was a teenager, I took photography. I had a little dark room at home. I could make my own photographs. I liked to paint. I like to draw, and yet like there wasn't anything where it was like, oh, this is my future. It just was a comfortable spot. But I do remember really clearly that like my happy place while I was going through high school was in art class and in art room. Also, maybe it was because everything, like the level of math science achievement around me was so high. And I was like, yeah, that's real. I'm not going to compete with that. But in art class and in that environment, it felt inspiring. And I felt like that was kind of more my world. And then, but I don't think I had like so much self-confidence around it. Nobody, except my art teacher, who was like, no, this is, you're really good at this. This is what you should do. And that just, you know, that person in my life was really significant. She's the one who, I think my parents were like, you know, they're busy and I had a brother and sister and their stuff was going on. And but this art teacher was just, you know, when I look back, so instrumental. And she really was encouraging me to try a lot of different media and, you know, just like super positive. And she found me this summer design program my junior year. And this summer after my junior year, I took her advice and I went to Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, which, you know, when you're like 16 or something like that, it was kind of a big thing. And I went there for the summer. It was like a month. And this program was just, you know, it was hitting me at exactly the right moment when I was like being forced to think about what you're going to do next. But I got to experience like a bunch of different majors in a college environment with professors. And it was just...
That makes it more concrete, doesn't it? When you can see the...
Concrete. I remember it all really clearly. I took graphic design. I took computer graphics, which is really funny because the mouse hadn't been invented yet. So like doing computer graphics on the keyboard, you know, illustration and industrial design, which I wasn't sure what it was yet. But I, in that summer taking those courses, you know, I got into that class and I felt like, oh, this is how my brain works. Like, this is super exciting because it's creative and I get to draw and I get to kind of make stuff, but I'm solving problems and I like that. And so in contrast of that, and then going to an illustration class where I was like, yes, my talent in drawing is there better than some people, but there was so much talent around me that didn't feel like, again, it was like, you know, my natural path. So
I've always really dug the challenge of solving problems and applying my creativity to that. But when it comes to like pure expression, like through illustration or painting, I can't channel my energy that way.
Right. And for some people, it's natural, right? It flows out. Mm-hmm. And then my brain was really much happier in this, like solving the problem in a creative way. Yeah.
Can I just go back for a second? That art teacher that found you this program and gave you that validation, was this at a public school?
It was at a public school.
Man, yep. Three cheers for art teachers. I've heard so many stories where just that positive and reinforcement and that window into having their creativity validated and their perspective validated in that way has led people to go on to do amazing things. And I
cannot imagine if that didn't happen, what my path would have been. At the time, it just felt like that's what happens in school, right? You connect with a teacher. But if that wasn't there, I don't know.
Exactly, which is why I just want to make one more plea that we need art in public schools. We need it for the health of humanity.
Yeah. And I think even, you know, I think of the amount of people in that art class, it was like home for, you know, not everybody was going into a career, but it felt like this really kind of safe place where people could put their head and their heart in a really supportive environment that was very different than going to your academic classes. And, you know, for some people, it was also the shop classes. I remember there was like this amazing shop where there was like people taking apart cars and putting them back together. And there was a lot of options beyond the hardcore academic stuff.
There is a lot, I think, of synergy. I'm not sure exactly how to explain it, but when you engage your hands and your mind and your creativity all in this same activity, there are a lot of things that get unlocked. And it can be expression, it can be problem solving, it can be a kind of rhythm that makes you feel kind of in harmony with the world. But when you're just sitting there sort of trying to digest information through your brain, those doors don't always get unlocked. You're not moving your body in synchronicity with all of that information. You're not feeling the materials around you and kind of learning how the world works. And
yeah, I'm a big believer in that. Like when you get your hands working, your mind can go places that it would not otherwise.
Agreed. Well, I'm glad that you had a public school that had shop classes and art classes because we got Kathy Bailey out of it. And Kathy Bailey decided to study industrial design at Syracuse. After that summer program, I guess that sort of helped you understand what could be your future. Is that
It was so clear. I came home and I was like, okay, I know what I'm doing now. Like, that was easy.
Wow.
it was really that easy. I thought, okay, so industrial design, that's what I'm going to do. And it just felt like a good fit. And I've had so much confidence after, like, yep, I sat in a class with a real college professor and I did the work and I loved it. And so great, let's do it. And then I was going to go to Carnegie Mellon, but I have this real like practical side that these practical voices in my head that kind of, and maybe it was my parents too, but I was like, I applied to other schools that were art schools like Pratt and Syracuse, Carnegie Mellon, and I don't remember what else. But the thing that I started worrying about is like, oh, what if I change my mind? What if I get there and, you know, something else is, you know, this doesn't feel right, or what am I going to do? I don't want to change schools. So I opted for going for a big school with a million other things you could do. And Syracuse, you know, was a place where they had amazing art facilities, sculpture facilities, but they had academic stuff that was sound enough too. And I look back and I'm like, but nobody told me to think about what part of the country you're going to and what the weather is like. And, you know, it was just like hell. It was really, really horrible. You know, that's not why you choose a college, except I look back and like, I would give people the advice to also do consider what it's going to be like when you walk home from class at midnight and, you know, or have to like get in your car and it's like frozen solid and you need like an ice pick to get to the key lock. But anyway, yes, I went north.
But when you work so hard for those little moments of glory and those little like cracks of sunshine, it's so euphoric.
It's true. I just like my memory is like the sun. I never saw it until like, you know, April. It was just was dark the whole time. Maybe it's because I was like studying. I was always inside trying to focus, but I don't remember any sun in that place.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Support for Clever comes from Wix Studio. Instead of reading you another, let's be honest, boring ad script, Wix Studio just sent me this wild-looking Alice in Wonderland-themed website to scroll through and tell you about. So, whoa. This is not the web I'm used to. There's something called mouse parallax, which makes it feel like you can go deeper into the screen. And as I scroll down, it's like I'm falling down the rabbit hole. And things are moving in depth and perspective. Even my cursor has morphed into a glowing little orb. There are all these no-code animations that make this place feel organic and alive. And Alice is wearing some pretty cool shoes, by the way. Okay, I know I'm mixing up my narratives now, but we are definitely not in Kansas anymore. Your turn to go down the rabbit hole. Build your next web project on Wix Studio, the platform for agencies and enterprises.
When you landed in Syracuse, other than the weather, did industrial design kind of always feel like the fit that you thought it would?
Yeah, I had an interesting path because it, you know, your first year you do art, you do this core foundational art, which felt really good. But then it was super exciting because my second year, I just felt like the people in my program, they were my people. Like we kind of thought alike, we really hung out together. We spent all of our, you know, social time and our work time together. We worked hard and it felt really good. But then I also became really interested in environmental design, and I started taking classes in that department. And, you know, when I was getting later in like the design education where I could pick my own project, I kept trying to like pick things that weren't what my professors were trying to get me to pick. I wanted to do bigger things. I wanted to do spaces. In the summer after my junior year, I went with the environmental design department to Italy and I studied there. And that was like really, when I look back at college, that was it. Those were like the moments when things really became like, you know, the foundation got built. Although I had this classic industrial design training, like I went to Italy and like I had never been there before and was, you know, looking and studying ancient buildings and kind of how like Romans thought about the cities and how that connected to buildings and place. And I loved that stuff. But I also think I started developing like my love for all things old and how things age over time and value in that. And all that stuff just became like, and culturally the differences, it just really was foundational. It felt like, okay, now I kind of have my feet on the ground and I start to know what I really, really like.
Well, it's interesting. So that time in Rome, you know, in contrast to growing up near Bell Labs and that environment, it must have really cemented in your head how objects and things assume their place in history and assume their role in the evolution of humanity and assume that the contextual relationship that they'll never be able to be divorced from because they represent so much about the time in which they were created.
Yeah, and it was that kind of permanence and that meaning that you connect to things that have been around for a long time and have gone through all these different phases in their life and all these different influences that felt really interesting, really important. And at that point in time, felt like where I was from, there was none of that. You know, I didn't have that perspective about Bell Labs that I do now. It was really like in my younger years where I had those feelings about it and I can look back at them now, but it really was, I kind of went to Italy and went like, oh, nope, this is the way things should be. It's quite opposed to everything else that I saw. And it's really good to do that. I think about that at that point in your life, you know, really remove yourself from everything that you thought the way it was and put yourself somewhere else. So like just creatively and culturally, it was super healthy to get that. So I went back to school and then I was like, okay, I studied industrial design, but like I ended up doing my thesis and it was like this weird. I took this vacant lot, and this was just a concept, took this vacant lot in Syracuse and I turned it into like this sculptural playground architectural concept. And that was my thesis, but I liked thinking about those kind of problems and even like, you know, the problem of the vacant lot in a rundown city was like, I liked the meat of that. So yeah, it was really interesting. So I left kind of, I kind of wrapped up the education going like, huh, okay, I studied industrial design, but I like thinking about things in like a little bit of a different way than like the regular track of that career leads you, because everybody else wanted to design sports equipment and, you know, like consumer electronics products.
Well, speaking of sports equipment, I think I read that you got sort of plucked right from school by Nike. So help right me understand that.
Yeah. So what happened after school is, well, I had two job offers before I graduated, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I had one from Nike. They had come out and done some recruiting there. And then I also had an offer from this architecture firm in Baltimore. And so that was definitely more in this, like, you know, designing space and parks. I can't even remember like why they were going to hire me, but they like my portfolio, I guess. Anyway, it was like, okay, there's Baltimore and then there's like Portland. It's west, you know, it's far away. And there's like mountains out there and I love mountains. So I went for the mountains. And they also had like, they had flown me out there and they had like shown me the campus and it was like very design focused. And, you know, I love design any way you slice it. So I was like, okay. And the funny thing was like, you know, my professors at school were totally against it. They were like, this is beneath you, you know, to design footwear. Like you really, really shouldn't go that direction. But
in some ways the Nike campus must have echoed of the Bell Labs campus, like, because it was just such a hotbed of generative activity.
You know, it did on the inside, but I was there before they even built the campus. So this was like in a, but it was super creative. It was like this, these giant, like industrial kind of just big industrial buildings and industrial park. Mm-hmm. And then inside they had built giant shoeboxes, like the offices, like Tinker Hatfield was working in a shoebox, like, and I was working like just outside the shoebox. And then like Mark Parker, who went on to be the CEO, was like in another shoebox over there. And they were all like, these people were really visionary. They were really cool. And they were all working in shoeboxes. Like, how cool is that? So
yeah,
it was a great experience. And I'm really thankful for kind of going right into that and getting this job that was, you know, very, as a designer, you kind of dream of where design is central to the organization. It's very supported. It's very integral. You were an important part of it. So that did feel really satisfying.
Oh, I bet. I bet. Because at that time, there weren't really that many companies where that were design focused.
The landscape of design on the West Coast, to me, through my eyes, was like, there's Nike and there's Apple. And then there was all these interesting design consultancies in the Bay Area. And that was it. There was like little ones in Portland, like that I got to, you know, there was other things, but the big things were like Apple, Nike, and then these kind of like cool San Francisco consultancies. And that was the world of design to me.
And how long were you at Nike and how did you find Portland?
I thought really that was my home forever. I just felt so happy there. And I was there for almost 5 years.
Oh.
And it was, you know, which was a good stint, I think, for your first job. Like, I got to do so much. I traveled a lot. I loved going to the factories. I loved even getting inspiration for, like, what could they do in the factories? How could that make a design different? And, but, you know, as I went through that process, then I started thinking bigger. And, you know, you're going through it and being like, like, how does this, like, this disconnection of the factory and the place of a factory in a culture separate from my own, like all that, I really got some good experience looking at and thinking about. And I wasn't so sure that that was really the direction the world should go, which was interesting. But so I was getting kind of opinionated about that stuff. And I just thought I need to do something else. But the biggest lesson that I took away from Nike was this, like, I mean, it became really clear this was a big company. This is a public company. And public companies' reason for being is really to make money for their shareholders. And that's that, you know? And so when you get to that wall, that's how decisions are made. And that's the point of it. You can layer on other things, but that was really evident that that's how the world worked with public corporations. And at a certain point, I was like, you know what? That's not really who I want to serve. So I want to try something else. So as it was great, supportive, I'm super thankful for it. But at that point, like, I had a pretty clear determination to go, I need to try something different.
Connect the dots for me. Did you go on then to found One & Co. from Nike, or was there something in between?
yeah, it was kind of, there was an in-between. Well, I left Nike. And again, like, I'm super practical. I was like, I can't leave Nike unless I have an income. So I was like, I worked out, like, I had a retainer contract with them already. And then I had, like, you know, I figured it out where I could move south to San Francisco, because that just felt like the sun would be exciting for a while. And I knew people in the Bay Area, and I just started consulting. So I already had like a contract with Nike, and I just really had the goal of going like, okay, I don't want to be find myself in like a footwear rut and to become known as a footwear only designer. So, you know, I came to San Francisco thinking like, what other kind of things could I do? And my boyfriend at the time worked at Apple, which was cool. Although Apple was very different in 1995. Anyway, I did do a job for Apple right off the bat. And then I did like other soft goods, but I quickly figured out that I really didn't want to work solo. And my experience in some ways was limiting. It like opened doors to soft goods and footwear. And so I ended up partnering up with this designer who I met. His name was Joe Tan. He's just a super, super good designer. He was really young at the time, and he did consumer products, and he came from IDEO, and we just started working together, and that was One & Co. So it was my soft goods experience combined with his hard goods experience, and we really thought like that was a nice combination to bring to product design at that time. Like, nobody was really thinking about products and materials in that way. So yeah, One & Co. started. And
One & Co. is a design consultancy. So tell me about some of the major projects you did under the One & Co. umbrella.
You know, there still was a lot of footwear. I, at the time, my dream project was designing snowboard boots, because that was where I liked to be, was snowboarding. So we took on that and did a lot of their women's snowboarding boots. We did other stuff. And then we were doing like, I don't know, like Logitech projects and, you know, more traditional industrial design, kind of consumer electronics stuff. And gosh, that went into even like conceptual stuff for like Microsoft. There was like early cell phone stuff, you know, all kinds of typical Bay Area kind of stuff. But
and in your mindset, in your heart, was the goal to just do as much interesting projects as possible? Or were you thinking about scaling this design consultancy into a big...
I think I just had, I wanted that goal of like experience in the design world and to really be working with interesting people. And that was like, that fed me for a little while. And, you know, and then my personal like things like, oh, it'd be great to design a much better snowboard boot and get to snowboard while you're doing that. Like, that was a great time. Mm-hmm. But then that wore off and it was like, okay, wait, where is this going? Do we want to be like, you know, what's different about this consulting firm than any other consulting firm? And the thing that the reality that came into my thinking at that point was like, okay, so now we're doing pretty well. There's like 10 people in this little firm, but in order to support that, we really need to have big corporate clients, because those are the ones that you can get bigger contracts with and that can pay the bills. And it was like, I couldn't figure it out on how to do something that felt really good.
Oh, now you're back serving the shareholders again.
That's what I was doing. And it's not that there weren't like good or interesting projects, but it just felt like I did that and I feel that same hole inside me. So what's next? So I couldn't figure that out. And I've, you know, there's other people who have done interesting things where they have been able to do more work that feels like it's making the world a better place. But, you know, for me, it was just like the path wasn't there. And the other thing for me personally that brought up is I realized that, so this firm became a little bit bigger, and then I really love to design things and solve problems, but the problems I ended up solving were like keeping the business working. Like, I'm the one who figured out like hired the bookkeeper and figured out what our finances were and got the contract done and made sure and told everybody like, guys, we need more, like we need to figure out how to get more projects. And then I would get the projects. And then my partners were like, they were incredible designers and they were doing amazing work. But it was like my role all of a sudden became like the glue that held it together instead of like the creative person. So it was still this like, how am I fitting in here? This isn't really what I want to do, but there's something I'm good at here. And I was like, okay, I think I have to exit out of this to figure that out.
How did you navigate a practical exit? Because that seems scary to me, like maybe you leapt.
So I think the way the path went is, so at this point, I was together with my now husband. And so we were partners, and he kind of had the same feeling. We had that, you know, that kind of bonded us together. It's like, what is it? What are we doing with our lives? And, you know, so we were super open. We were out there like looking, what is it? What project? What company? What should we do? And we were super open and exploring a lot of stuff. And then I wanted to buy a house in Sausalito with him. That was kind of like my relationship thing is like, look, like I already have this house, and if our relationship is going to progress, like, I don't know, is that practical? What is that? I don't know what that trait is in me. I'm like, no, we need to buy real estate together. So, like that's commitment or something.
I totally feel that too.
It seems very unromantic, but it did. That's what we did. So I was like, okay, let's buy a house. So we bought this house in Sausalito, and then the Heath thing came shortly after that, and it was complete serendipity. But it was like everything had led up to us looking for something like that. But things like Heath don't exist. So generally,
right. So you don't even know that that's what you're looking for because
no.
Yeah, but now you've got a partner in crime. You're building a life together and looking for your next creative adventure.
Well, then, like, the two of us are always, like, we're always looking around, and we have the similar, like, I think, point of view on, like, what seems interesting and stuff. So, you know, yeah, the building of Heath that we had, we were talking about this the other night. We're like, what's the real story? Our memories are really fuzzy. Like, were we riding our bikes? Were we at the vet across the street? We don't even remember. But the thing is we had been by this building, and it was drawing us in. There was something really curious about it. It was like this factory. You could tell something was going on. There was a very, very small tile Heath sign outside. And I took me a while to go, oh, that's like the Heath. That's like the dinnerware that I used to see on eBay. Like, it took a while to even collect that. And Robin had never heard of it, but we checked it out, and there was a little shop, the same store that we have there today existed, but it was just, there was a lot more piles of stuff and it was a lot dustier. So it wasn't as clear as you go in today and like, oh, this is clearly like beautiful mid-century in origin dinnerware. But we went in and thought, but this is really interesting. This is amazing. There's like, this stuff is being made in this factory right here in our town. And yeah, I was immediately fascinated. And that brought back my, like, there's a factory in my town and I'm a designer. Like, there's something here for me to do. But as soon as we started talking to them, just casually, we realized like, there's no, like, this is a skeleton crew of people running this. Like, they can't do any new design or anything like right now, because it's not a solid foundation for this business. As a designer and with my experience in consulting, you're like, you're kind of, you know, if you want to do business with someone, they need to kind of be able to pay you or something. But so that was clearly not what they needed. They needed something else. But we started chatting with some people working in the store and realized that it actually was pretty serious and it needed to find a new owner immediately. Otherwise, the doors would close. It couldn't survive as it was. So we were like, really? That's interesting. And so we just kind of went home and got like really fired up. And we're like, wow, like maybe we could figure that out. Someone in the store gave us the number of the woman who was the trustee for the business. And we called her up and it was in contract with someone else. And we're like, oh, that's a bummer. But she's like, you know what? I like the conversation that we had. Call me back in 2 days. And we called her back in 2 days and it was like, you know what? That deal isn't happening. Send me your proposal in a week. And so we did that. And it was like one of those things where you're like, well, let's just do the next step. Let's just do the next step. And then we'll see, like,
because it just felt right each time. You didn't know what kind of a ginormous leap you were making necessarily.
There wasn't any really ginormous leap. It was just like next step. And then it was like, here, okay. Here we are. We did this. It's a good memory of just like, No fear. Just like make another phone call. Just ask another person a question. Just get another answer. And then it happened and we were on, okay, so here we, you know, got friends and family together to kind of help make the whole thing work. And we're the majority owners of this kind of crazy old, wonderful place, but one that didn't have a secure future at that point. And yet we just were like, it's not going to be a problem. We're going to make this work.
Wow. And Edith Heath was still alive? Was she in good health? Or did she?
No, she was not in good health, but she was alive. She was 93 then. Okay. So, and she had a full-time caretaker and she had dementia. So Jay Stewart, who was the woman who we ended up buying the company from, and she was a friend, a family friend of Edith. She did the most wonderful job, like being like the best possible human to make everything happen and to take such good care of Edith. But, you know, Edith couldn't, you know, make any decisions about the business, but, you know, her heart was still there. And she came, Jay had brought her by the factory one time just after we closed, and she came through and she said, like, oh my, you're still making my Heathware. And like, she did understand that like her legacy was continuing. And it was like, you know, everybody was just emotional about it. And it was
I'm emotional now. You must have felt so proud.
We felt really proud. We're like, okay, we're going to do this. This is her life's work. And we're going to take it and keep that and make it ours. And it's going to happen. And there's no other option. It's going to work. So I think the transfer of her, like, you know, her heart and her understanding, her legacy was continuing is a pretty, pretty feel good thing.
Oh, it's super powerful. And I'm guessing there was still with the skeleton crew, all of her knowledge had been transferred into the crew and therefore could be transferred to you.
It wasn't such a tidy place, like with well-organized like SOPs and notebooks full of documentation. It was a bit of a like, stories had been passed down from the elders, kind of.
Right. So it's just like crumbling recipe books and stuff like that.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. And typewriters and, you know, one computer and accounting. But you know what? It was enough. And it was all perfect. So that's why, like, we were able to have it, because it wasn't buttoned up and it wasn't clear. And you had to figure it out.
Nobody could just come along and buy Heath. They'd have to really relish doing that work, dusting off what's really valuable about it and also implementing new systems and protocols without losing any of the timelessness or what's valuable about it or the humanity in the brand.
Yeah, that was the goal. I mean, that's always what we felt. Was it? And it was like, I think the cool thing is Robin and I, like, we didn't have to really even communicate that to each other. Like, that was instinctual. That was the goal. That was what was important. It needed to be sustainable as a business and nothing else could be compromised. And it was just going to work and it had to work that way. But, you know, Robin is really good about getting advice from people who are experts, and the experts were telling us it wouldn't work. But
that's always daunting. Fuck those experts sometimes.
You know, they're like the typical experts. It's all the things we learned is like, you know, we live in the Bay Area. There's like experts on what business is. And we already knew at that point in our life that what everybody thinks business is not what we thought it was. Mm-hmm. So like they have a lot of knowledge. And so there's stuff you're going to learn, but you're not going to just take the what people think business success is all around in this area and apply it. So it was like, you know, most people were suggesting, look, like keep your factory open, but find another source somewhere else where you can really rely on like bigger production. And, you know, you can balance it out with some of your kind of quaint production, but you're just not going to be able to make a business work out of that factory solely, you know, which is not like, if our goal was to like build a big business and sell it, like that was sound advice, but that wasn't our goal. And that's what, at that point, no time, nobody could really understand why that wasn't our goal.
And that using that word quaint, like it's a dirty word as well. Like,
yeah,
it also sort of implies they don't understand the heart, because the clay is sourced locally, right? And there's this tremendous craft tradition.
There's a lot of craft. There's like, when you really dig into the product, there's some very specific things about it that can't be compromised. And I think really make it kind of feel unique and keep it what it is. And so all that is really important. And at the same time, we knew, like, look, for us just to kind of just to continue doing exactly what Edith did in exactly the same way also wasn't super interesting. Like, we wanted to, my goal was always like, okay, like, we want to take that legacy. How do we make another chapter for Heath that's creative, legitimate, noteworthy, and is something that the world also should have alongside all of Edith Heath's work?
Yes. So tell me what you guys did.
Yeah. So, well, it's been a lot. So it's like 17 years now, which is a long time to be working on a project, feels like, for me.
And you bought it in 2003, correct?
2003. Yeah.
And in 2004, I registered for Heath pottery for my wedding. My wedding didn't last very long, but my Heath plates are still in the cabinet.
Well, you can rely on those.
Yes.
Oh, no. I mean, those stories were something that gave us a lot of confidence because, you know what, there's people's grandmothers even going like, I registered for Heath, and then like a daughter would come in and register for Heath too, or a couple would come in and they had relatives. And like those connections, like what kind of product kind of transcends that? It just isn't very common,
right?
That it goes through generations and it's still really loved and appreciated. It's been a long journey, and it's been pretty much all positive. I think we set pretty clear values in the beginning, I think, and we have always stuck to them. You know, we came in, there was 25 people, including us, in 2003, and now there's 230. And that's a lot of change in scale in people, and the world's different than in 2003, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
The past 5 years or so, I mean, it was like, you know, our first e-com was like some Yahoo store where we sold like 12 SKUs or something like that. And now it's a big deal. And now we work hard on doing that. And we opened a new factory in San Francisco in 2012. That was really important to us to kind of open a facility that was done in a way that we believe was the right way, or the right way for us to manufacture in our own community. And we wanted to create a manufacturing facility that was surrounded by kind of a creative compound, for a better word, of like ourselves and other creative work, give spaces to other makers. And we have our store in San Francisco. So that was a really big project for us. It's now several years ago, but that works out really well. We have a store in Los Angeles.
I just want to interject for our listeners to say that I've been there a few times, and I think what you've done there is not only a beautiful showroom of Heath ware and the other collaborations that you do and some other nice products, but it's a celebration of making in the heart of the city. It's not relegated to some industrial park where space is affordable. It sort of says in an unashamed and unabashed way, like, this is our heritage and this is how we make our product, and we want to share this with you and we want to share it with the creative community. And it feels like an incredibly, well, it's hip and beautiful, but it also feels like an act of generosity that is coming from the humanity of the brand.
That's so lovely how you articulated that. I mean, that's the dream. That was what we hoped. I think there are things that we try to do that it feels like it does make it a real genuine place for community to happen and creative endeavors to happen. And we do a lot of events, a lot of talks, a lot of them are free. It does feel like a nice connection point. It's tough even seeing what's happened.
It's sort of like a Bell Labs, but not as sciencey. It's more of the earth.
It's more definitely
room.
More of the earth. Yeah.
Whoa. Now, Kathy, now that we've opened up your brain, I'm starting to see all of this. That's amazing.
Yeah. Okay. That was the dream, was the, you know, we wanted to do that. And it's like, it feels it good. And it is inspiring to have that work that's also outside of your work that you're doing with your company. Like, we do have other people working in the building that aren't Heath. And so it kind of doing that to us was important, you know. And now it's like, the question is like the scale of all these things, like, what more do you scale up so you can do more of that? Or do you not, do you just kind of go, this is a really wonderful thing, let's keep it going as is? That's really not an option, but
well, right. I mean, you sort of have to keep growing in some direction. That doesn't necessarily mean bigger, but it does mean evolving. And
that's exactly the right point. I love how you said that. See, it doesn't mean you have to grow in the direction that everybody thinks you have to grow. So it definitely doesn't mean that.
Yeah. And you as a problem solver, is this the type of problem that still has juice and meat to you? Are you still feeling every bit as invested? You know, with One & Co, you described having become the glue that holds it all together. And you sound like the glue now, too, but in a different sort of way.
Yeah, that's such a good observation, because I am in some ways, but not. But I've been working, Rob and I have been working over the past year pretty hard to bring some other people in that we believe have kind of our point of view, think like us, but also have some different experience, so that it's not personal. It's not, Heath should no longer be like just our personal vision. And we feel pretty strongly about that because of the scale that it's at. And we really honor the incredible jobs that we create and the incredible people that are here. And we want that to continue on. It's really important. So as much as, you know, the two of us might at some point be like, gosh, you know, we'd like to not be at the head of like this larger company. We want it to be successful. So, and successful means maintaining those jobs, maintaining like careers for those people that can continue to grow, and never compromising on the values. So that's the problem to solve. It's not just my problem to solve anymore. It's a very collaborative kind of group that we have with really cool other experiences that they're bringing in. And there's nothing that feels better than that knowing, okay, it's not just, you know, Robin and I and our limited personal experience kind of that's going to help it adapt for the next phase. And there's always a next phase, right? You've always got to be doing that. That's exciting. So in answer to your question, like I do want to be a part of it, but I don't want it to be just totally personal. And I do want to also have other projects that I work on. And so, you know, for a long time, I've been 150% Heath. Like I feel like I am Heath. And, you know, at this point, I feel like I'm in it. I'm a part of it. I want to contribute significantly, but I also have some other things I want to be able to check out and focus on as well.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that, and it sounds like a really healthy perspective, because I'm just thinking about the first chapter of Heath. It didn't have a succession plan, and as Edith's health started to fail, you know, I don't know if it was a direct mirror, but the company also couldn't sustain itself without new stewards, you and Robin, to come on and really value what was built there and help it adapt to a new world.
Yeah, I think you completely hit the nail on the head that, and we could see that. And it was sad because for Edith and Brian, it was completely personal and they were so attached to it that they couldn't let it go. They couldn't let anybody's ideas come in, and they couldn't let, as the landscape changed and the world changed, they couldn't see that. And you can see as you get older where that becomes different. You know, your experience can sometimes cloud a path forward instead of enable it. So getting different perspectives in and making sure it's not personal is super integral to it. And yet I still believe, I mean, it is personal. It's always personal. There's no like, but it's not wholly surrounding just my personal view.
It sort of reminds me of, and I don't have kids, so maybe this is going to sound corny, but it sounds sort of like raising a child and then recognizing that child has to go to college and you're always going to be the parent. But now the world is taking a much more active role in raising your child.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah. And you're still always the parent.
Yeah. Right?
That's a lovely way to kind of articulate. Yeah. Next phase.
So in terms of your own creative process, Your love for Heath and your integrity with regard to its stewardship and, you know, evolution is super apparent. But what about Kathy personally? You sort of mentioned having other creative pursuits and wanting to keep yourself not so insulated in the Heath world that you can't bring fresh perspective. So how do you keep yourself active and fueled with new experiences?
Yeah, it seems pretty important to me at this point in my life, because you could still like see how you can get sucked in and this can be my life and that. And there's another thing, and this is really personal about it, but I'm like a tragic introvert, like really hardcore. It's just who I am and I know I can't change it. As the scale of the business has gotten bigger, and to do it well, it really needs this kind of leadership that is takes my energy in a really intense way. You know, like I walk around and I don't know everybody working here anymore. And that thought creates so much anxiety in my daily life, like that experience, right? So there's all this introverted stuff that I have to like deal with. My happy place is kind of like working with a very small group of people. I love collaborating, but so I need to structure those kind of projects for myself. And like outside of Heath, you know, we've also built over the past few years this rhythm into our life where we go away for 2 months in the summer. That gives perspective to everything. I always like thought back, like after, you know, we had never taken more than 2 weeks off for like, you know, a decade. And then it was also because my son was getting older and I was like, okay, it's now or never, like, because he's not getting younger. None of us get younger, but that time really that you can take to look inward. And it's been really important. I draw a lot. I paint during that time. And then when I get home, I realize what those kind of things give me and I need to keep them going. And I get to read a lot. That 2 months, we travel, we road trip for 2 months.
Oh, I love road trips.
Personally, it's been like that distance from it to make sure that it's not consuming me. And then it's given me other directions that when I get back, I pursue. You know, I have ideas, I have projects that have all like incubated on that time away. And it's funny because that time away is like an introvert's like heaven. Like we're out there, we go to Alaska or all the way up like to the Yukon, and there are only bears and like moose and stuff. And yeah, it feels really, it puts your head in a different place. And then when I think about the stories I was telling you of me growing up, I mean, can you imagine? I never even fantasized I could do that, to be at those places in the world that are so immensely beautiful. Yeah, it feeds me.
And then as a tragic introvert, in your words, does that time away also allow
kind
you
of negative.
Well, I mean, I feel you, because you have to foster a culture at Heath and keep people motivated and invested. And there's a charismatic output that has to come from that. And, you know, not all creative people can fathom all the tolls that like their creations will be exacted from them. So you and Robin built this amazing entity, and now it takes a toll from you in terms of your introversion that maybe you didn't anticipate, or now you have to manage with self-care. And
yep, I didn't anticipate it. I didn't think about it. I think I've become much more aware of it by taking time away and then like just really kind of looking inside and going like, who am I? Where do I feel like I get energy from, and what takes it from me? And then you realize like who I am and the role that like Heath needs someone to fill right now that I filled in the past, like that's not ideal for me. So I have to carve out my own role that's going to be different so that I can contribute and kind of lead in my own way. But like everybody isn't dependent on my charismatic leadership, because that's not who I am.
That sounds like a pretty important discovery to make about yourself, and maybe one that starts off with a lot of resistance.
Well, it starts off with a lot of guilt, right? Because you're like, why can't I just get over it? And you're like, yes, you could do that, but it doesn't put you know, your mental health in a very good place, and probably like just like it will destroy you. So that became apparent to me that like, no, and why should I need to do that? And there's so many, we have incredible people here that I work with now that is who they are. And so they can flourish as well. And it doesn't mean I can't be integral, but the roles can shift. And the cool thing is, it's like, who's stopping us? Like, we can do it however we want.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the beauty of how you evolved, Heath, in the second chapter, is that you don't have to be what everybody thinks you should be. You can be whatever suits what the raw material is asking.
Yeah. And yeah, we do have to talk about it a lot because people still think.
Yeah. Yeah. As like an introvert, I bet that wears on your nerves.
Yeah, you got to do the work.
So from discovering industrial design at 16, which sounds kind of like a dream and also a little bit scary because you want to make sure you're exploring your options, but through Nike to One & Co. to Heath, your life sounds, or it can look, pretty charmed from this vantage point. But I know that's not a super fair and accurate depiction of anybody's life. Are you willing to share with us, like, maybe a disappointment that you've lived through and learned from?
I do feel like, you know, the thing we were just talking about, you know, who I am and trying to learn from that, because I feel like I have let people down and in the past, you know, just kind of not even realizing like who I am and what my nature is, and I get misinterpreted. So there's that kind of stuff that I've learned from. And so, you know, that's always disappointing when you realize later in life, like, oh, like that, how I was acting or something wasn't how I really wanted to be taken. So there's that personal stuff, but I don't have much regret. And I don't know if this is like being an introvert, but like the people stuff at work is really, really hard when it doesn't go as you hope it will, when things just don't work out, you know, and like nothing is just business. There's nothing I hate more than when people are like, hey, well, I had to make that decision. You know, it's just business. Like, that's bullshit, because people are real and they're humans and they have feelings, and all that is has to be considered. But I think I have learned, Rob and I have both learned, and we're much better about how to communicate through things that, you know, when there's employee issues, when companies' needs are changing, when people's performance is not merging with things that need to happen from a company perspective, and wrap in like real humanness into that, like we've gotten really good at that. But there are a lot of situations in the past where I wish I knew how to handle them. It's hard. It's just hard for people, and you don't want to make things hard.
What I'm hearing from you is somebody who's, for better or worse, a compassionate and empathetic leader. And so you feel the anguish of others in addition to your own anguish when things aren't working out well.
It's exactly right. And plus, I've just learned a lot about how you can work through those things. Anyway, those are the things I've learned, is there are ways to kind of feel better and do better. There's ways to communicate that I didn't know in the past. You just kind of think, well, you can't just say it. And you're like, no, you can actually.
Yeah, that radical candor idea, is that something that you've learned?
I think it's somewhat that, but it's also communicating in the moment. It's really like letting people, giving a lot of feedback all along the way. So you're kind of always course correcting. And generally, like, you're able to get people like on track better. So, but also, you know, if you're doing this course correcting, like, it becomes apparent, like, it's not like a yearly thing that you bring up or you assess a project like after it's done. It's just like, it's a culture. And we're working really hard on that culture. And it's not like naturally who like Robin and I are. That's why, you know, we kind of had to learn it and to run a company that's a company we want to have and that we feel proud of. Because when it was really small, I mean, those situations were, well, not that we were good at them, but they weren't as impactful as when the culture becomes one that's just not as transparent and the feedback is not, you know, done in a way that everybody feels like they know what's going on, they know where we're going. I mean, this is funny, this is a tangent, but the biggest lesson of, in any of this and in life, is like, if you know where you want to go, like, you have to tell everybody. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows where you're going. Generally, they will like help you get there. And all the problems start happening just like in your personal life and everything. And if people don't want to go where you're going, then often they usually figure out like, oh, I don't want to go there. I better like get off the bus. Yeah. So, yeah. And that's like so huge for like running a business and even like creative stuff too. Like if you're not going, like you don't have the same creative destination, like why are you working together? Like,
you mentioned road trips. What does the road ahead look like for you personally?
Well, you know, we did get into some of that, whereas I've hired a couple new people. It's been about a year or so that I've been working on that. So personally, my role at Heath is going to change, and I hope it can be more creative and less like leading everything. And I'm doing, like, my goal is to not have what happened at Winnico, where it was like, okay, I'm the glue, so now I have to just exit. So I don't want to do that. I want to kind of form my role where I can really be who I am and help guide the brand and do creative projects, but not be the glue that holds everything together. So that's my personal path at Heath. But then I have, you know, I have some other projects that I'm working on, and some of them, like mundane as this sounds, it's been really fulfilling to me is I've spent the last year and a half training, doing leather work, like traditional hand leather work, right? Like it's a skill, not designing the stuff, but actually just doing the craft. Like you sit there and hand stitch for hours, and you have to stitch for like days and days and days until your hand stitching is at all like tolerable. And then to make it really beautiful, it's like intense labor, right? So personally, I want craft skills. I want more of those to be like in me, and I want those to come together with design. And I don't want that to be like commercialized. So I'm working on some stuff like that. And then I have another like more of a kind of environment project that I'm working on as well, which, you know, probably connects to Heath in some way, but I'm trying to approach like some of these projects like outside Heath so that the goal is not for it to become commercial. The goal is to keep it creatively clear. And then, yeah, if it ties together, awesome. And if it doesn't, and it's just personally fulfilling, that's great.
Do you have a project in the works, either Kathy Bailey or Heath, that you want to tell our listeners about that they can follow along?
I just have those seeds that, yeah, they're too much seeds right now to kind of like spell out. Yeah, there's this one that's about gathering an environment, and I think that it still needs to kind of it still needs to gel before it needs to bake okay. up a little bit.
We'll let the dough rise.
The dough needs to rise. Yeah, the yeast needs to be just right to get it to the right point.
Okay, well, we'll be following along anyway so that when the bread comes out of the oven, we're there cheering you on.
Thank you.
This has been really nice, Kathy. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you for chatting.
Hey, thanks for listening. To see images of Kathy's work and read the show notes, click the link in the details of this episode on your podcast app or go to cleverpodcast.com where you can also sign up for our newsletter. Subscribe to Clever on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you would, please do us a favor and rate and review. It really does help us out. Please also check out our sponsors' offers and support us by supporting them. We love chatting with you on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Clever Podcast. You can find me at Amy Devers. Clever is produced by 2VDE Media with editing by Rich Straffolino and music by L1011. Clever is proudly distributed by Design Milk.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.